The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 50.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to bring someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show. By popular demand, the last interview we had was completely awesome. Everybody loved it and said, get this guy back on. He gave us some incredible investment ideas, and he's here again today to talk a little bit about macro, but to dive into a couple ideas that I think you're going to like even better than the ideas that he presented the other day. So Chris McIntosh, welcome back to the Rebel Capitalist Show.
It's good to be here, George. Thanks very much for having me on.
All right, buddy. Let's just dive right into the questions. Right now, we've got this really interesting situation with the S&P 500, where it goes down faster than it's ever gone down in history. And correct me if I'm wrong on that. And it goes down by like 33%. Then we have this huge rebound. I think 4,000 points it gains. And then it's kind of just gone back and forth. Now it seems like we're in this holding pattern where is you're kind of asking yourself, okay, is all of the downside to what's going on with the we'll call it the illness for YouTube, is all the downside already priced into the market? And I hear a lot of bulls saying that. From my standpoint, I'd say, well, maybe that's true, but the 700 in QE, the QE Infinity, the repo, all the other money printing that's going on, the Fed stimulus, the federal government stimulus, $2 trillion, all that's baked into the market as well. So are we at a fair value right now, or do you see this kind of being the eye of the storm?
I actually just think that's the wrong way to look at it, because your risk of getting whipsawed is high. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is, if you kind of just step back and say, okay, like we can take, here's the problem. Markets are forward looking. So you're looking at any particular, like it's just a collect, when you say the markets, it's a collective of all those companies. And we pulled out one of those companies, like Apple as an example.
Yeah, right.
And you say, okay, you know, what's Apple valued at today? And that's when you're trying to value it today, you're actually valuing it based on what it's going to look like tomorrow. That's all that we're doing. Like today's value is actually just a representation of what we think it's going to be like tomorrow or a year's time and so on and so forth. So when you look out and you go, okay, fine, what are its earnings going to be? What are it, or is it, have the expenses gone down and all those, all the normal types of things that we, you would value any business on. So forget about Fibonacci levels, excuse me, forget about any of that sort of stuff. What you're just looking at is saying, is this business viable? And is it cheap or is it expensive? The difficulty is that the market, participants in the market don't quite understand, or they don't know what their future looks like. And on a normal basis, if you didn't have any interference, then you've got less metrics to work with, which makes it easier. You simply look out and you go, okay, you have to make some base assumptions. You say, okay, well, we think possibly GDP is going to contract by, and you come up with some figure, which is based around unemployment numbers. It's based around how many industries have closed, how many you think will actually open, and how many will actually go away, and so on and so forth. And you work through all these various matrix of different guesswork, really, which is all that analysts do, and you come out with some figure and you go, okay, I think that's what the economy is going to look like in 6 months' time, in 12 months' time. As a consequence, what should Apple's earnings look like? And you can come to a figure, and then you can work it back and go, oh, is it cheap or is it expensive? Now, the issue that we have today that makes this more complex is that that's based on a market without any interference.
But like we've Fed got you're talking about Fed intervention.
But we're talking about massive interference in both from the Fed as well as from governments in terms of so the Fed's they're doing QE and they're doing a whole host of different things. But on top of that, you've also got government stepping in with bailout packages for individuals, for corporates, all these other things. And that is such a fast moving target. I mean, it's almost every day we wake up and there's some new something. And right. And a lot of it's not even getting, you know, mentioned because it's not top line news. It's top line news if it's a $2 trillion package. But there's a whole lot of other pork that gets thrown into different sectors, and it's very difficult to keep track of it all. And so that changes all of those dynamics around what is, I'm just using Apple as an example, what's Apple's future earnings, what should they look like? For me, if, look, I don't know, the bulls might be right, the bears might be right, and I've got friends on both sides of that aisle, and I'm preferring not to play that game per se. What I prefer to do is really just step back from all the chaos. We know that there's demand destruction. We know that there's supply destruction. This is the first time that we've actually really ever had both at the same time.
Yeah.
And then we've got this phenomenal stimulus, call it what you will, just call it intervention. That historically was always, well, certainly post GFC, in fact, even prior to that, it was QE, and it was a manipulation of the yield curve, which is, so it was a credit stimulus, right? And I think we've reached the end of that particular game because the in fact we've seen that, you know, the Fed cut rates, didn't the market just kept falling, and so the credit stimulus side of things has pretty much run its course. I also don't think that the Fed are going to go down the negative interest rate path. Japan and Europe tried it, and it didn't work. And there seems to be a consensus amongst all of the pointy shoes that that's not going to work. And I agree. But then that leaves you with few other alternatives, which is where I keep coming down on the side that we don't really have any other options available to us other than A, fiscal, and B, MMT. And MMT, when I say MMT, just for people, it's modern monetary theory, which, and you know, for those who follow it, don't yell at me, I'll try and simplify it, but it's basically a monetization of debt. That's really what, in its simplest terms, that's what it comes down to. And so when you look at that as the options available, then I look back at now and I go, what's the S&P at now? What's it going to be? And really, I think it's the wrong question to ask, in that if we look at what's likely to take place, investment is just a matter of probabilities. What's likely to take place, in my humble opinion, is simply that they're going to have to monetize debt. We've got $256 trillion global debt, something like that. God knows what it is today. It's probably more. And in terms of debt to GDP, we've well exceeded pretty much anything that we had in the past. If we go back and look at Rogoff and Reinhardt's work on that, they came up with a figure of roughly 80-90% debt to GDP. If you exceeded that, no country really had the ability to actually pay back those debts, and we well exceeded that anyway. So you'd say, well, how do you get yourself out of that debt trap? And there's two ways. One was the deflation, which was what we had in the Great Depression. And we know that central banks have spent a lot of time understanding that dynamic. I mean, that was the crux of Bernanke's work, was the study of the Great Depression and ensuring that we never went through that again. But it's not just Bernanke. So there's a wide swathe of academics who sit in these positions that have studied that and feel like they understand it. So I think the probability of us going down that path is much less than it would otherwise be. It's like the general always fights the last war, right? If you always got attacked through that door, you kind of know that you got to barricade that door. And that's what you focus on, because you're like, I'm not letting that happen again. So I don't think the probability of it, of a 1929 style deflationary outcome is very high. That combined with the fact that we've had this increasing attention to MMT, and many people suggesting that that's both reasonable and will produce the results that they anticipate, I think leads us down that path. So that, and that path is quite different. So it's, to be clear, it would be inflationary. I can't see any other outcome, or to be more specific, stagflationary, as in you can have an inflationary outcome. Previously, our inflationary outcomes were as a consequence of global growth. And that's another problem. People say we can't have inflation because growth's falling. Well, that's just rubbish. You can easily have an inflation in any particular asset price, whether you have a deflationary, broad deflationary environment or a broad inflationary environment. We just think about something like Asian swine flu or Asian bird flu. In those instances, so like with Asian bird flu, nobody wanted any chickens, right? So they slaughtered a ton of chickens. So your demand collapsed because no one wanted to eat a chicken because they thought they were going to die. And so all the farmers were like, well, nobody wants our chickens. So they slaughtered them all and they replaced them mostly with pigs. So broadly, you could have had either an inflationary environment or a deflationary environment. But in those two sectors, you had deflation in chicken prices. Because
right.
Even though your supply was collapsing, your demand was collapsing more.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But in pigs, you had massive inflation because the supply was not sufficient to take up for the demand for pigs as a result, because it had moved from chickens to pigs, basically. I'm trying to simplify it, but basically you can have inflation in certain asset classes or deflation in asset classes, depending on a number of other things. And so when you think about MMT and you think about the consequences of that, that's, and it's also a direct injection, if you will, of stimulus to the patient, and the patient being the individual, the consumer, not like we had QE. QE was basically just shoveling capital into the banking system, and a lot of that they just parked in reserves. So it never found its way into the bank, into the real economy. And the other thing that took place was that for a bank, their objectivity is to make money, and it's much, much easier to make money on leverage. So guess what? Well, the capital that did get funneled in found its way into stocks and bonds and real estate. Because, of course, you can leverage that. Like, what, you know, so you had the funnel, basically the hose got turned to that sector. Now they're looking at saying, oh, well, if we push it into the banks like we did last time, and the banks are fearful, as they will be, because you've got a collapse in all those collateral that they've typically been using, stocks, bonds, real estate, they're fearful. So they hold back. And if you can park the money in reserves and earn a small yield, you just do that. And so it's not going to find its way into the economy. So they're saying, well, move the hose and channel it down this path over here. And I believe that'll have a very different outcome in particular sectors. It's not going to necessarily send your real estate back up or your financial assets back up. So back to your question, to a certain extent, I'm not interested in that question. I'm interested in what are the consequences of this chaos? Where are we going with it, and positioning according to that on a longer term time frame?
If that's the focus, how do you make a decision on when to pull the trigger? Like in last video that was just wildly popular, and this is kind of backed by popular demand getting you back so soon. But you were talking about tankers, or you're talking about coal, or 3D printing. So how do you know, okay, like today, as an example, we're in this holding pattern. We don't know if the bulls are right. We don't know if the bears are right. So do you pull the trigger on one of those now, or do you wait a week, or do you scale in? How do the pros do it, or how do you do it with your fund?
I think the way to think about it is you buy things when they're cheap and you sell them early. It's
you're telling me what I tell everybody.
Literally don't. Here's the problem. No one's going to know. I mean, like, unless you're a technical trader, and I've got some friends that are very good at that. And look, that's a different game altogether. 90% of people can't play it. And I mean, can't play it because psychologically it's very tough. Right. I traded FX for just under 2 years full time. And it was one of my most profitable periods of life, but it was I was a shitty person to be around.
Yeah.
It was not good. It was not good for me. It wasn't good for my family. It wasn't good for anyone. And the reason behind that is because it's incredibly stressful.
Yeah.
Your average person shouldn't put themselves in a position like that. And I don't put myself in that position anymore either. I just don't. So when to pull the trigger? Look, if something, think about a business. Like, so if you're going to buy a business that's not a listed equity, let's say you and I decide, fine, we're going to go and buy.
I used the example of a gas station the other day.
Yeah, a gas station. We're going to sit down. We're going to look at what the balance sheet looks like. We're going to look at the income statement. We're going to value this thing and we're going to say, would we own that company? Is it going to pay us every year to own this thing? And can we staff the place? What's the OPEX going to be? What's the work that we might need? We'll factor it all in and we go, yeah, this is a great business. It's on the main highway. There's always going to be traffic. Cool, this is a good business. And we don't worry about what the market out there might price it at tomorrow or the next day or the next day. We just say, is it going to pay us, in terms of return on our capital? Yes or no? What is the price we'd be prepared to pay? Maybe it's a little bit expensive. And we go back to the owner and we go, look, we want 10% off or whatever the case might be. And then if that's the case and that's the way you view a market or an equity, or you can either just put in a stink bid at that price where you feel that that's real good value, or you could sell a call option on it and have it put to you at a price that you would want. So I mean, I just, you're gonna get whipsawed otherwise, George. Because you're never gonna necessarily know where that bottom is. And then what happens is you get, the market's now it looks like it could, this could be the bottom, and you buy it and it goes up and you think you're a genius, and then it collapses. And guess what? It was a dead cat bounce. What do you do now? So, and I'll tell you what people do. They'll panic and they sell because they're not just stopping and looking at it like a gas station going, hey, did I want to own this thing or didn't I want to own it? And so the broad market, is trying to trade that broad market, unless you're a pro. And even then, I mean, it's just, I think it's the wrong way to look at it. So I'd rather look at what's that long-term thing. My long-term view is we're going to have a stagflationary environment because there is no other way out for this incredible debt burden. Mm-hmm. And there's going to be some assets, which I think, on a nominal basis, like people ask me, is real estate going to do well? Look, we've got a vast majority of the populace in the Western world that are indebted. So politically, it's pretty tough to turn around and shaft them and tell them, sorry, mate. So it's easier to simply deflate away that debt.
You mean inflate it?
Sorry, inflate away that debt.
Okay.
And that would be politically more feasible. And what you're doing is you're sacrificing the creditors for the debtors.
Right, right.
And I think that makes so much sense on multiple levels.
Right.
I don't, doesn't matter whether I think it's a good thing to do. It's just like, it doesn't matter that none of that matters. It's only really what is likely to happen.
The pushback to that would probably be, okay, Chris, well, they tried to create inflation for the last 12 years, but they weren't able to do it. They're always struggling to be at their, call it 2% target. But I think the way you would answer that is just earlier in our conversation, you'd say, well, they're just pointing the hose in the wrong direction. And now they understand it's that
two
they
things.
Need to
point the hose. They pointed the hose, but the other thing was they were using credit as the instrument. To manipulate asset prices, and that's going to change. If they monetize debt, then it's a different ball game.
Right,
it's a different ball game. So by monetizing the debt, you actually deflate the debt. Right, as a whole proportion of that debt load, you start deflating that debt. And when people then there's a feedback because people start figuring out, oh. It's quite simple. Like, let's say your property that you live in is worth, I don't know, $1 million and it doesn't go up in value, but it doesn't go down, right? But then you go to the store every day and suddenly it's 10% more and 15% more and 20% more. Your wages haven't gone up either necessarily. And that's your stagflationary period. The last time we really had that at scale was in the 1800s. And so people tend to not think about what that could look like because they haven't studied it and they haven't looked at what could take place. But what we're seeing right now has never taken place before. So you can throw out the rule book on a lot of this stuff.
So you see it differently than the 1970s?
In the 70s, it was just inflationary. It wasn't stagflationary per se. Back in the 1800s, you had a truly stagflationary type of environment.
So how would you define stagflation? Because the typical definition I hear is just high inflation, high unemployment. So your misery index is extremely high. Do you have a different way of seeing it?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. It's a stagnant economy. So your economy isn't growing. If people wanted to get an idea of what it looks like, it tends to be statist economies. Because what happens in a statist economy is that the government crowds out the private sector. And when it does so, it typically, in whatever that sector is, it's inefficient. Or
right.
Certainly inefficient comparative to alternatives. And so... in those environments, you will have stuff gets produced, but it gets produced very inefficiently. Mm-hmm. And there tends to be a lack of supply. I guess the most egregious type of example would be Venezuela. And no two ones are the same. There's always, you know, many nuances to any particular country or any particular economic system. But by and large, you have a crowding out of the private sector in one or many industries, which makes them inefficient, and it causes the cost of whatever it is that they're producing to be higher than it would otherwise be.
Right.
And so that's a stagnant, shitty economy. Where
even inflation is going up in real terms, there's not much GDP growth, real GDP growth, when nominal GDP growth could be at 3-5%.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if you look back at the post-GFC, there was the nationalization of essentially the auto industry, the insurance industry, banking industry, and to their credit, they stepped out of that. They managed to actually step out of that, and that was always a threat. That was always a risk that you would have really moved away from capitalism to some statism or I don't know what you want to call it, but they did manage to actually step out of that and kind of hand it back to the private sector. This time, that's going to be more difficult. We're seeing people putting their hand out in every single industry, and they're going to, because this is a major economic destruction impact. So it doesn't matter if you're in the tourism industry, airline industry, hospitality, restaurants, you name it. This is really, really widespread, which is why, why I think they're going to go down that MMT path. It's very difficult to, if you have one particular industry and you can see it's in trouble, you can bail it out and you can try and manufacture something around that and have the rest of the economy essentially support that industry. So if it was just airlines that had shut, and that's big enough on its own, you can kind of support that. But it's not just that. It's also tourism. And it's also so many other sectors. So right. How do you then like create departments to deal with each one and how much? It's just, no, they're just going to, so they're going to, they'll do some bailouts, I think, in terms of major industries. But by and large, I think they're going to say, bypass all those corporates and inject it directly into the patient and let the patient try and spend its way up. So you have a trickle-up effect rather than a trickle-down effect. Right. And that is a very different way of going about doing it. It also means that the capital, the way that capital gets spent is going to be quite different to the way a corporate would spend the money or a corporate would allocate that capital.
Right.
So, and that's more like a psychological issue. If you've lost your job and you now got some cash to spend, and you get an injection, you're gonna hoard it. You're gonna initially you're gonna just pay for your necessities, but it's not gonna go into typical discretionary consumer spending. You're not gonna go out to the restaurant and go, "Hey kids, we're off to the movies." That's not gonna work. So you have the where that capital gets spent, how it gets allocated.
Yeah, so the fire hose is pointed at your just consumer staples, and it's not pointed at share buybacks or corporate debt or something like that. So that, I think that's really the takeaway, is you've got to be cognizant of where the money is going, what types of goods and services will it chase. We're going to get into some more of your investment ideas, because those were just wildly popular on the last video. So we're going to get into that in just a moment. But I want to just ask you maybe one or two more questions regarding the macro, so people understand the environment, because that's key before you look at the investment ideas and what might be right or wrong for your portfolio. So we talked about how you think on a moving forward basis, the government is going to be a lot more involved with the economy. It's going to make it less efficient, less dynamic, therefore producing fewer goods and services, while at the same time, they're taking more money and injecting it into the system, chasing those goods and services. That's why you're seeing this stagflation, prices go up. So I got that. What about the yield curve? So we've heard of the, I think Brainerd it was, came, and a lot of people have talked about it, going back to World War II, where the Fed knows that they've got to keep interest rates down. If the 10-year goes up to 3%, 4%, 5%, that's going to do almost as much damage as the illness. So, and I think it's confusing for people, because just your average Joe thinks that the Federal Reserve controls the interest rates. But the way I see it, they only control and barely control the Fed funds. And that's, they've been losing control of that. You can just see it in the repo market. So I guess my question is, does the Fed control interest rates? If so, do they control the entire yield curve?
In theory, no. What worries me in this is that they can pretty much do anything that they want. If you look at how Japan has essentially just controlled the entire bond market in Japan. I mean, it's one of these places you just don't show up. Why would you? You know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
So there's basically, there's no private participation in the Japanese government bond market.
Yeah, there's no buyers and sellers because like, the BOJ owns the thing, right?
Yeah. It's a little bit probably like if you were going to have a sports game with Kim Jong-un, a game of tennis, like why turn up? Because you know you're going to lose, right? Yeah. He's going to win.
Yeah.
Either that or you're going to get a bullet in the head and you're like, yeah, I think I'll let him win. So there is the ability for central banks to do that. And I do think that allowing interest rates to rise too much, given that we have such an indebted, both sovereign, at the sovereign level, we have so much debt, and at the corporate and even consumer, less so than the consumer level, but at the corporate level, so much debt, that they'd be extremely hesitant to let any of that do what it should do, which is clear. Because a clearance at this point is would just be freaking catastrophic. It would just, you know, so I think there's, and I think that's why they'll just need to inflate away that debt over time.
And that's why they kind of peg the yield curve. So, and if I'm seeing it right, so they try to peg the yield curve, meaning, and what that means is, let's say the 3-month T-bill, they're not having too much problem with that, but the 2-year, the 10-year, the 30-year, they've got to keep those rates down. And the way that the Fed would keep those rates down is they would print more money to buy the bonds. That creates more demand. It drives the price up and the interest rate down. But, and correct me if I'm wrong, but that's the only way that they could try to control the long end of the curve. Is that correct? And that's why it's inflationary. Yes. Because that's more money in the economy, right?
Yeah. And so I see this as only two ways out of that. One is exactly what you just talked about now. But that presupposes that there is a buyer for that debt that they issue.
The Treasury.
If there's not, yeah, if there's not, then they have to come into the market themselves. So you kind of move into a Japanese type of situation there where they essentially control that side of the market. And the other is that when you move down that path and they're monetizing the debt, because they have to keep the yield curve under control, so they're monetizing the debt, you then start seeing that impact on particular asset classes in terms of inflation. And so if you think about a bond, a sovereign bond, a government bond, all that really it is just long dated currency. So a dollar, a euro, a pound sterling, whatever it is in terms of the currency, if you wouldn't own the short dated, then why would you own the long? And if you wouldn't own the long, why would you own the short? There's no reason to own it. And so we quite quickly move into a breakdown in the faith of owning that particular currency, right? And the thing is, that can happen really, really quickly. And so you can then have a situation where you don't have, it doesn't really matter what the yield curve looks like when nobody wants to own the paper. And so you can have, come back to what I was talking about, which is a stagflationary environment, that can kind of grind its way higher, or it can just flip really quickly and you can move into a situation where it doesn't really matter what they're doing with the bond market. Nobody wants to own the paper, so it essentially just goes away. And I don't know how this works out, but part of the reason why we've not had anything even of remotely like that so far is we've never had a situation in the world where the major liquidity options in currencies or bond markets are all pretty much in the same boat, and that's the euro, yen, dollar. There's always been some sort of exit valve, right? So if you go back and you just think about the Mexican peso crisis, you had this problem there, not particularly dissimilar to that which we have in the developed world today. But there was an option out. And so the market went, fuck it, we're out of that. And they moved into dollars. And so you had a strong move in the dollar and into dollar-based assets. Because on a relative basis, that's where you needed to be. So the dollar was where you needed to be. It was much, much stronger. The economy was stronger, blah, 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 blah. Today, we've kind of got euro, yen, dollar, and they're all just really ugly. And so you see the capital kind of shifting around, trying to figure out which of those three ugly girls to take home at the end of the night. You know, it's like you're forced to take a girl home and you geez, you know, you've got to have another drink because they're all ugly. And you've got to pick one at the end of the night. And that's the market that we're in right now. And that actually, it creates more systemic risk because it's allowed those participants to do things that they would never have been able to do in isolation.
Their currency would inflate to oblivion.
Yeah, and the bond market, you know, the bond vigilantes have always, you know, fixed that problem to a certain extent. You go back to like the Asian crisis. I mean, that was it. You had the the bond vigilantes figured out. I'll say bonds. I mean, it was just the market really figuring out that you had over indebted countries and originally developers, but just, you know, equity markets and a mispricing of assets. And so they called it out and you had that shift of capital that left from that area and went somewhere else, but it had somewhere else to go, George.
Right.
In this instance, large pools of capital don't have anywhere to go. And so they've kind of been stuck in this Hotel California. You know, if you're a big currency trader, one of the sovereign wealth funds or anything of that, even doesn't even need to be that big, and you need to move a portion of your portfolio, you can't do it without being euro, yen, dollar. You know, people say to me, oh, well, you could buy gold. I'm like, for fuck's sakes, you can't. Are you kidding me? What, you're going to move, like, you look at some of these sovereign wealth funds, and you've got to move even just 10% of that cash allocation, you cannot move it into anything other than euro, yen, dollar, maybe sterling kind of thing.
Chris, can you just unpack that quickly here? I don't want to interrupt your thought, but for those of you, the viewers are saying, what is Chris talking about? Because, and correct me if I'm wrong, but if you've got a sovereign wealth fund that has $100 billion, and let's say the gold market is, and I know it's not this small, but let's just say the gold market was only $10 billion and they've got to allocate, let's say $50 billion. What do? They can't buy $50 billion worth of gold. And even if they could, because they're so huge and there's such a massive amount of capital and the market is relatively small, even if they were able to buy a certain amount, it would move the market tremendously to where they'd buy it at a super high price. Is that?
They'd hurt themselves. Correct. Yeah. They'd hurt themselves. And there would be a massive dislocation in the market, because remember, if you look, it's all about liquidity. So if you've got 10 billion and you're trying to move it into a small, relatively illiquid currency, we just think about currencies for the moment, forget about the gold market or silver market or any sector or whatever, and you wanted to move it into, let's take a really illiquid currency, Malawian kwacha, okay?
There's one, okay.
you will not be able to move that because there's no liquidity in there. You would normally, if you were going to take a $10 billion position, you would have to structure that trade over weeks or months and drip feed it, and you would still move the market.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like buying penny stocks, okay? It's essentially what it comes down to. So you go, okay, well, I'm not going to do the kwacha, and you kind of keep moving up the curve. Well, what about the South African rand? It's a bit more liquid. Yeah, okay. And you get to the point where when you've got too much capital, you just can't move into these things without hurting yourself.
Right.
And so...
So the only option is the dollar, yen, or euro, period.
Correct. Now, that's been the case for some time. The paradoxically, that has allowed for the central banks and the governments of those countries to do things that they would never have otherwise been able to do if there was an exit valve, because right. They're all in the same sort of boat. And that can go on for as long as it can go on for. I don't know. I don't have any monopoly on the future or the truth. But what we do know is that going into this crisis, that was at extreme levels. Our debt to GDP levels were at extreme levels. And now we're going into a position where those debts are going to explode. I mean, the Fed, what are they doing? $6 trillion over the next 9 months. Fed's balance sheet's about 4.5. So they're doing like 150%.
That's it's now on Chris top. Chris, you're like 2 days behind. The Fed's balance sheet now it's like 5.3. That 4.5, yeah, that was like 3 or 4 days ago. Yeah, get with the program, Chris. My goodness gracious.
Yeah.
It just gets ridiculous, doesn't it? It's just
So you have this, it's like the gas, let's go back to the gas station. Okay, so we're going to buy the gas station. And we sit down and we're like, oh, okay, so they got some debts. Income is, let's say they got $500,000 of debt, $250,000 a year of income, and we'll just forget about OPEX. Let's say that OPEX is fairly meaningless. Okay, well, that's reasonable enough, depending on what the interest rate on the debt is and how it's termed, right? Now we come back 2 weeks later or a month later, and the debt's no longer $500,000, it's $1 million. But your income, and your income's not $250,000 a year, it's now half that, $375,000. That's essentially where we're at. So the debts are exploding and GDP is collapsing, and we know that tax receipts are completely tied to GDP, irrespective of the tax rate. We've seen that. Been proved you can tax people higher or lower or whatever, doesn't have a material impact on actual tax receipts. So tax receipts are collapsing. That's back to our analogy of the gas station, 250 grand has gone now to say 175, and the debt's just exploded. So yeah. Would you buy that company? We're like, yeah, nah, this doesn't look so good. So then the question is, would you buy government debt? Would you buy? And again, government debt is just long-dated currency. So there's a period, I believe, a window where people are in this crazy, what I call the liquidity phase. But when they come out of that and they start looking around and they're going, well, if I wouldn't own that gas station and there's a share on the gas station, which is like a printed dollar, I don't think I want to take that dollar because I'm not sure what it's going to be worth tomorrow or the next day. And then when they start seeing that inflation pick up in their everyday life, their behavior changes. So back to your question of the yield curve, they can keep the yield curve flat, but and you can keep elevated certain asset prices on a nominal basis, but on a real basis they're falling in value.
So that's the key, is it is possible to peg the yield curve, but it's going to come at a price. And the price would most likely be the value of the dollar compared to what you, the average Joe or Jane, buy on a daily basis. That's the bottom line.
That's the bottom line. I mean, we get this crazy stuff that you can think about, and I don't know how this transpires, but given the fact that we have these three major blocks of currency and bond markets in the world, and the fact that they have gotten more and more elevated, is it possible that they just blow up, literally pop? And what does that look like? It's always a possibility. In fact, in isolation, it would be a massive probability.
Right. Now, I just want to unpack that for everyone. So if there wasn't a Japan option, a euro mm-hmm. option, or a USD option, excuse me, a yen, euro, USD option, if it was just a yen option or just one, then it would be more probable that the top would blow and we'd have this volcano, meaning
you'd have an exit valve. Okay, so let's pretend that Europe was fiscally sound, that was, you know, it wasn't doing any of these crazy things. Japan was doing them, going bonkers. The US goes and does them, goes bonkers. Well, guess where the capital is going to move to? It's going to move to Europe. That's the exit valve. And it's liquid enough, it's deep enough to take it. And so those other two countries would have that experience of an inflationary blow up, and the bond markets would collapse or get severely repriced. And they'd go back and do what pretty much every country in history has had to do, devalue their currency, And thus, when you're just devaluing the currency, again, you're keeping the debts at a nominal value. So yes, you get paid back, but in worthless dollars or yen or whatever it is. But that's presupposing that the euro was could take those capital flows and was a place where you would want to put your money. The problem is that today none of those exist. They've all done it at once, and so there's this cluster of huge liquidity, and it's the only place to go. And because there's no other real alternative, it's kind of gotten bigger and bigger. And now we're at a point where it's just going bonkers. It's just you know, trillion is the new billion. Nothing's off the cards anymore. You literally throw the rule book out on all this stuff. And so the question is, where does that go? And in that environment, you can have this, if we had a blow up of that nature, then we'd have a move into hard assets, because people would just scramble for something that has some tangible value. And I'm not sure what that looks like. It seems to me more likely that they will just simply do some sort of debt moratorium, because it's debt that's the problem, and I'll just have to almost collectively do a massive rewrite.
Like a jubilee, debt jubilee.
Like a debt jubilee. And we've never, you know, the debt jubilees that I've tried to study, and there's not a ton of information about them, they're also done under a very different monetary regime. So you're kind of not comparing apples with apples, you know what I mean? So it's hard to know what that would look like. But what does seem fairly obvious is if you've got something that is in infinite supply, it's less, should be less worth less than something that's not in infinite supply. And if you just go back to, I mean, we're experiencing this right now. You're in lockdown, we're in a lockdown, much of the world is in some form of lockdown. And when you see what people start concentrating on, they're going and they're hoarding food and they're hoarding cash. You know, there's a safety mechanism where you stop and you start thinking about what really matters. You know, that barista made latte that people thought was really important suddenly is kind of out the window. It's not that important. They're out getting toilet paper. So if you just think about it as a psychological move, people focus on what matters. They focus on what actually is critical to their well-being and their safety and security. And then you can extrapolate that out to many other things. And I think there's plenty of opportunity that comes out of this. It'll be super chaotic, and I don't pretend to know exactly how it functions. But back to your question of what's S&P going to do, largely I don't care. I really don't care. There will be moves up and down. I'm not buying the S&P. I might be buying some companies that are within the S&P, but that's a different kind of trade. What I'm doing is I'm going back to the gas station. I'm going, what is going to survive? What does it look like? What does it look like further out? And if it's really cheap, and some of the stuff is just painfully cheap, then I'll buy it. And then the way to deal with the inevitable gut-wrenching volatility is to ensure that your position sizing is such that you just don't have to worry about it. Mm-hmm. So if you went in and you put 50% of your portfolio into something you thought was like a bloody good deal. Look, I'll give you a good example. We talked about coal the other day.
Yeah.
And I think coal is basically very similar to the tobacco stocks in the 90s. So in fact, it's better. But in the 90s, every tobacco company was being sued because we found out that tobacco, lo and behold, kills you. So and what the market failed to understand was that you have a global market. And so they're very centric in terms of the Western world, which is where most of the media is concentrated on. And these things got absolutely obliterated, and they paid a few fines and everything else. No one was really paying attention to the fact that outside of the Western world, people still smoked, and they were increasing their consumption of cigarettes, particularly in Asia. And because they'd been repriced such that they were priced for bankruptcy, they were paying massive dividends. And if you had in the 90s just gone, look, these things are not going away. Cancer sticks are going to stay. People are going to, you know, and in Asia, if you paid attention, they're going to still smoke.
Yeah.
You would have just bought the snot out of them. And over the next, that has been the best sector to date.
Really? Since the 90s?
Since the 90s. There's been no better sector. And no one, and still nobody even knows it. And part of the reason was that you compounded all those dividend payments as well.
Right.
So, and look, that was just understanding the globe and looking at consumption trends and then the pricing of those assets. If we take something like coal today, it's in a similar sort of situation. Much of the Western world has decided that coal is the enemy and we can't use coal and so on and so forth. But if you just dig down and you look at, firstly, there's met coal and then there's thermal coal, very useful different things. So metallurgical coal or coking coal is used to make steel. And so if we just forget about thermal coal, which is burnt for electricity usage, which is still 40% of global electricity usage, but we put that aside, we say, okay, are we going to get rid of coal? Well, if you get rid of coal, you get rid of steel. So good luck with that.
Right.
And are we going to stop building with steel? You know, and then you look at things like cement. It's a major component in the manufacturing of cement. So like when you actually dig into what it's being used for, it's like you realize it's if it goes away, it just means that the price of those other things readjusts and that the portions in the world that are producing and using coal are going to be in more in demand. It's just, it's either that or we stop making shit with steel. And I don't think we're going there. Anyway, the point is, you kind of look through, you get the biggest dislocations where you have a big market or a big zeitgeist that moves one way. So like tobacco companies, oh, you can't own tobacco companies. Are you mad? These things are going away. I remember all the articles, you know, they're going away. We're not going to have them. And that was the best place to have your money in. You could have just sat on that for like 20 years and you would have made out like a gangster. And so, you know.
This is a great segue, though, Chris, because I know a lot of the viewers who are watching this right now are just really super excited to hear some more of your investment ideas. That last video was just, I got a tremendous amount of positive feedback on that. Probably the most positive feedback I've ever had on a video. And that includes Peter Schiff and all those people that are really big names. So, and I can see why. Even when we were talking, what you were saying, it was just kind of like really the light bulb came on. So let's first dive into coal because we talked about that the other day, and I've gotten some very good comments pushing back and saying, well, I think Chris is a smart guy. I think it's interesting, but it's got this problem. It's got this problem. And it's not necessarily that coal's going away, but specifically we were talking about the ETF coal, which is KOL. So, and I was saying that, hey, listen, it's got this great dividend. It's, but one of the, and I'll just kind of give you some of the rebuttals and you can kind of go over if you think that's correct or how you see that. And I think it's so important that whether we're looking at macro or we're looking at other investments, that in order to be truly educated and know that what you're doing is right for your own portfolio, I think you've got to be able to argue both sides extremely well. I think if you can just argue one side and just totally ignore the other side, I think you're doing yourself a disservice. So let's kind of play that game back and forth. First of all, with coal, KOL, they only pay a dividend once a year. So you've got to hold this stock for the entire year and just hope that they make that dividend payment. And if they don't, then shoot, you've held this stock that's probably going down in value or down in price, and you don't get the benefit of why you own it in the first place. So what would you say to that? Because it's a great rebuttal.
Yeah, I mean, there's two things, of course, because you can buy it for a dividend, but if your equity price goes down 10, 20%, like, it doesn't really matter. Like, you know, so that's the first thing. And again, if you go back and for anyone that's interested, you can have a look and dig into the tobacco stocks and how dividends were changed a lot in that very volatile period. And equity prices were very volatile. So, like, if you went and you in 97, I'm trying to think there were a bunch of big cases that came out against, like, British American Tobacco got sued. They had to stop advertising. They weren't allowed to advertise anywhere, and a lot of them slashed dividends because, like, they were in that phase where they were going, holy shit, we got to make sure that we survive. And so they were slashing dividends. Equity prices were getting cut. So you could have had a situation, for example, where your dividend was, just say for shits and giggles, 10%, and then the equity price would get hammered, which would, if you'd bought it at the new equity price, your dividend yield was now maybe 20%, right? But then they'd slash the dividend, and you went through this sort of chaotic period where they essentially stabilized. But the thing to think about is buying in that chaos there, where you could, it comes back to what I said at the start, like, you buy what's cheap. You're never going to know whether it will get, it might get cheaper. Mm-hmm. But you gas station, right? Would you buy it at a certain value? You go, yep, that's cheap. Tomorrow could, you know, the owner could have said, hey, I'll take 20% less, and you get a 20% cut, but you're never going to know if that's the case or not. So you've got to buy what's cheap. And if the ability that you've got with the stock, with fairly liquid stocks, is that you can dip your toe in, and you can put in maybe a half a point position or something like that, and then even put in stink bids. But the point is, you're never going to know exactly. But back to your question there, with the tobacco stocks, over the course of, like, the next 20 years, if you'd put in, what was the numbers we were looking at before? It was 97. If you'd put in, I think it was an investment of about $15,000 between 97 and 2016, just your dividend payments amounted to $50,000. So you put in 15, you got 50, and then the equity prices all repriced over time, because you were buying it at that point where everyone had said these things are going away. They're not, they're finished. And you can pull up the charts on all the various companies, you actually went through a period of shit, almost about 7-8 years, where it was like this. It was very volatile. It was a situation where you'd second guess yourself, George. You'd be like, oh, it's going up. I think I'm right. And then you'd be like, oh, fuck, it went down again. And you had this kind of very volatile period. And you tend to get that at the bottoming of markets, where it's forming a base.
Right.
But over time, then it's you know, all your sellers moved away, and you kind of, the base was formed, and off you went again. And yeah. So back to your question on coal. It's a very, whoever mentioned that is dead on. You can have dividends can be cut in these companies. The equity price absolutely can get hit. What I'd suggest you do is just go and have a look at even individual companies. I mean, coal's just an easy ETF, but you can go and there's plenty really good companies out there. And then you just look at their debts, see if they've got debt. Is it termed out? What's it look like? What are their cash flows like? And then you're back to that gas station situation, and it's much easier to look at that. I mean, I could throw one out there. Stanmore is an Aussie listed one. It's got no debt.
Zero, literally zero debt. Like literally zero. I looked that up.
No, there's zero. It's got a return on equity is about 80%. Trades at a PE of about, last I looked at about 2.8. It's probably cheaper today. I mean, that's the thing. I don't care. Like trading at a PE of 2.8, that was when I last looked at it, probably a month ago. And I'll buy these and then I'll just, like, I'm not going to sit there and worry every day and go, oh, what's it at today? I don't care.
But because it's not 50% of your portfolio, that's key, I think.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. Few going people have the stomach to be able to manage that if it was a 50% position. However, I would be far more comfortable owning a company that I know has no debt, that I know is not going away, than owning something like Tesla. I mean, people have like shit like that in their portfolios where it's like a 10, 20, 30, 50% position. And it's like, anyway.
Yeah. So, okay. Going back to just kind of the coal sector, and then I want to move on because I want to give people some, they've heard the video and what you're thinking about, but I want to get some new tips from you, some new ideas. So, but just quickly on the coal thing. Now, if I'm correct, a lot of these coal companies went Chapter 11 in 2000, maybe 16, 17. So if you look at the dividend, like in KOL, prior to 2017, you're like, well, this is nothing special. Now it's let's say $1.05. Back then it was only like 5 cents or like, 10 cents or something like that. But correct me if I'm wrong, but what they're doing is they're looking at two completely separate balance sheets right there.
Yeah. You can't, they're not the same company. I mean, it's,
yeah, right.
It's been restructured and yeah. So you gotta be careful. Don't go and I've seen people do this. They'll pull up a chart and they go, oh my God, it was $100 a share. And now it's 20 cents or $2 or whatever the case might be, thinking that it's going to go back to $100 a share. It's not the way it's a different company. So you got to just look at it and say, well, what is it today? And
the same thing with the ability for them to pay their dividend.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay, great. So we talked about that. Let's move on. If you've got like three more ideas or even a couple more ideas that we didn't mention the other day, and I know you've got tons of these ideas in your research letter. And at the end of this video, we'll go ahead and mention the promotion that you guys were nice enough to do for my viewers. We mentioned that on the other video, but we'll save that for the end. But a couple more ideas, a couple more things you're thinking about out there that would do well because of this crazy environment where you're saying there's a lot of opportunity.
Look, we've got about a dozen themes that we're interested in. In the short term, you know, we talked about tankers before. That's a now. That's a right now. It's almost most of the time we're looking at long-term investments, and you know, shipping in general was. Down anyway. It's very difficult to find anybody that's covering shipping, and included in that basket are tankers. So tankers are just the ones that carry fuel, and so they are just don't even finish watching this. Just go out and start buying tankers because that's a no-brainer trade.
All right, so we've talked about that before. Let's just actually focus on one idea that we didn't mention the other day, which would be a cheap play right now, considering the environment, but something that you want to hold for like 10 years, 15 years, that's just a really deep value play.
Energy in general. So within the energy, I mean, we could talk about uranium. I'm going to get a little bit into the weeds. Energy is, I believe, going to become very localized.
Okay.
So, and we've had this global market where energy can move around the world, whether it be natural gas, coal, lignite, oil, whatever you like. And I've been talking about this for ages and ages on the blog. We're moving more into a world whereby geopolitical tensions are increasing, And very importantly, the US military is stepping back from that global role of patrolling the oceans. That's going to have really significant impacts on supply chains, on the cost of moving goods. And what it's going to do is it's going to force people towards particular energy sources dependent on their location. This virus that we're experiencing, or the world we're in now, is just accelerating that to an extent I'd never imagined possible. So I'm really excited about that. But there's a lot to unpack in that. But I'd suggest to people to focus on energy, and you can look at particular countries, for example, and see which country would use a particular energy source and why. And so obviously coal fits into that narrative, but uranium is another one. It's massively underpriced. There's every reason to believe that on a global basis, we're going to use much more than we have in the past. We're already seeing the build out of nuclear facilities to that extent. And the other thing behind that is there's a lot of actual misinformation around the uranium market. And for anyone that's listening, I'd strongly suggest spending some time and listening to Mike Elkin, who's a good buddy of mine. In full disclosure, I'm invested in his fund as well as we own a number of positions within.
So how would someone watch those videos, Chris? Is that YouTube?
Yeah, he's got stuff on YouTube. I've done some podcasts and stuff with him. You can search our blog, and there's stuff on there.
I think uranium is perfect because I know I've got a lot of viewers that are really interested. So I'd be happy to own that
for the next 10 years. You know, if you're talking about that trade, would you own? Uranium, definitely. Or maybe not 10 years because uranium tends to reprice really quickly and then go from like severely overvalued to severely undervalued. And part of that is also because of the consumers of uranium are price insensitive. The utilities just don't give a shit really about the price. They need supply. Supply is most important because the cost component within a nuclear facility of uranium is tiny. It's inconsequential to their overall operations.
Right. So
they don't really care what price they pay. What they do have to have is supply because they can't run the whole thing without it. And so it creates a very extremely exciting market if you're wanting like real asymmetric moves in any particular commodity. But so uranium is really, really great one. But you don't need to listen to me. You could talk.
And then what would the bear argument be? The intelligent bear argument for uranium, and why would that be wrong?
The intelligent bear argument revolves around what the industry pricing mechanism has been. And I don't really want to point fingers, but there's an industry consultants, I guess they're called, that the market uses to understand what the forward rate of uranium pricing is. And I'm not sure if they're incompetent or if they are or what, but they're wrong. And I know that's a big thing to say, but the issue is that no one's focused on that market for so long, and that kind of fell into the space of actually becoming the price providers in that space, and none of this should make sense. It doesn't make any sense at all. And so there's a severe mispricing in that market. And I don't really know exactly how long it takes for the market to figure that out. But as long as it doesn't figure it out, that's our window of opportunity, in my opinion. So that's uranium. I mean, I haven't seen a rational bear argument against uranium.
From what I've heard, there could be an alternate source that's, and the name is escaping me. I apologize, but it wasn't uranium. It's like this new type of energy source that is competing with uranium that they haven't used at all, but it could come onto the market and completely make uranium obsolete. You probably know what I'm talking about. Is there any validity to that?
You know, it's funny. I used to run a venture capital firm, and I can't tell you how many people would send me through revolutionary new technologies that had the potential to do any number of different things across all sectors. And in my younger days, I would have gotten excited about it. My answer now is, show me industry using it. Now, that doesn't mean that some of these technologies might not have the potential to do that. They might. But until I actually see take up by market participants, it's irrelevant. It is irrelevant to me, because even if it is the best thing since sliced bread, unless someone's going to use it, then it doesn't really matter. And of course, people will turn around and go, well, that's your huge opportunity. No one's figured it out. You should, you know. But I could, if I had put a dollar into every single idea like that, that seemed plausible, I would have spent $1 million. And you know how much I'd have to show for it today? Nothing. That's the reality. So investing is a matter of probability. And even if there's some technology out there that's wonderful and amazing, unless the market actually takes it up, it's not worth my time. The other thing is that I don't have the ability to understand. I'm not a scientist or a biochemist or whatever it is, depending on the sector. So I don't have the technical competency to really evaluate those, whatever it is, whether it's an energy source or whatever. That's the first thing. The people that have the competency to do that are the ones that are staffed in the companies that would benefit from it. And so when I see those companies taking measures towards that particular sector, then I get interested. That's one of the reasons we talked about hydrogen. So hydrogen is something that we spend some time on. Again, do I think hydrogen is the best thing? Is like, I don't know. I can read like everybody else, and I can go through the data in it, and I can have a bear or a bull argument about it. Where I get interested is when I see an uptake. So like, we got interested in hydrogen when China basically flipped their whole subsidy programs and said, screw it on EVs, we're going down the hydrogen route. Of course, Japan's been down the hydrogen route for a long time. They want a whole hydrogen economy. And so those kinds of look, maybe both those governments are completely stupid and it's uneconomical. It doesn't really matter. If they're going to go after it and they're going to spend billions and billions of dollars developing hydrogen-powered cars, trains, buses, they're going to do it. It means that the companies that are producing that, and they're going to do well, you know, whether I think it's a good idea or not. And so, you know, back to the whole uranium side of things, same thing. I mean, I can't tell you how many people keep coming out with different solutions and so on and so forth. Until I start seeing industry take that seriously, then I don't have the time for it, really. So outside of the bare arguments for uranium that I've seen, all center around data I believe to be inaccurate.
All right, okay. All right. So what do you think with uranium, what do you think your downside is? What do you think your upside is? And I guess the timing, if the asymmetry is extreme enough, that I guess the timing really doesn't matter. But do you have any idea on the timing?
So far, you know, when we got into, we started looking at uranium 2016, didn't really do anything. And then late 2017, and by the way, I messed up on uranium. I took some small positions, what was it, maybe like 2013, 14, somewhere there. And what I didn't understand and many participants didn't understand was the whole underfeeding. So underfeeding created a massive supply of uranium in the market, which I never understood. So I completely got that wrong. Fortunately, when I position sized stuff, as mentioned before, it was such that it didn't wipe me out. And I sold out of those positions at a loss. That whole underfeeding has now been soaked up by the markets. And I would guess we're probably no more than a year or two out from real supply crunch on that side of things. And most of the bulls that actually got in to uranium got burnt, and they've been hesitant to come back because they got burnt. And Remember, they came into it when it was already pretty cheap. So you had this kind of long bear markets. Pretty much everybody got washed out. You had a few participants who started getting back in because they thought that was the bottom, myself included, and then they got washed out. And so it's a very unique market in that there's very few people who are willing to put their hand up and say, I think this might be it. Yeah,
there's no more buyers left, or at least there's no more sellers left, that's for sure.
Correct. Yeah, exactly. So it's what's the downside? Look, prices can go anywhere, especially in this kind of market. In a liquidity driven market, you sell what you have to sell. It's just that simple. If you're a fund manager and you get a redemption and you've got some uranium in your portfolio, you flog it. The good thing one of the things that people could look at is there's the uranium ETF, which is URA, which by the way is garbage. I wouldn't buy in it. But when people try and get exposure to a sector, they'll often say, well, you know, is there an easy way to do that? And sometimes there's an ETF that will give you easy exposure. The problem with that particular one was they restructured it a year and a half ago, and they put a whole lot of equities into it, which aren't really uranium. They're kind of loosely correlated in some shape or form because they just needed more liquidity because no one's even playing in that sand pit anymore. So the downside to that is that if you're buying that, you're not really actually getting exposure like you think you are. And there's two sides to this. So if you go and you bought equities that are not in an ETF, when you have redemptions from large asset managers, they typically, you won't get a downward pressure in those equities that you're into, yeah? Because they're not in that ETF. The corollary of that is in a bull market, when people pile in, that's the first thing they'll pile into. They'll be like, oh, I'll just buy an ETF. And so you can have stuff going up in an ETF, which doesn't, like, they think they're buying uranium and they're buying the ETF. And so you like have equities that are going up, even though they're not actually directly related to that ETF. So it's just something to think about. To protect your downside, it can be quite useful to look at stuff that's not listed in an ETF, because in a liquidity phase like we're in now, when you get margin calls, that all takes place often in indexes, ETFs, passive type algos. Those companies don't, those trading houses and portfolio managers won't often go out and buy, you know, some company listed on the ASX that's not in an ETF, or some company in Canada, or whatever the case might be. So you can limit your downside, you know, as a consequence. But remember that in a bull market, sometimes you might want to look at it because you have the stuff that's sitting in the ETF will just get fund flows because it's in an ETF. Of course, if there's something that moves into an ETF, then you can have a real re-rating. To a certain extent, that's what we've seen with Tesla, right, George? So Tesla has benefited massively from so many different, it's been included in so many different ETFs and index funds and so on and so forth. You know, pretty much anyone, like I was talking to a mate of mine the other day, and he's got a friend of his who used to work with Soros, who's now going out and raising some money for an UCG, whatever fund, and those guys will go and they'll buy something like Tesla, just because you can't have, you know, in theory, you can't have something that's all about EVs and saving the world and all that, and then not own Tesla. So they just buy it, and they don't care about whether it's what the price is.
It's like a PR thing. It's not really like an investment.
Yeah. And that's dangerous territory. I mean, that's like, if you're into momentum trading and all that, fine, knock yourself out. It's not a game I want to play.
Yeah. So when you talk about these opportunities that may or may not be inside the ETF, and maybe some of them are on the Aussie exchange or the Singapore outside the US, for your readers, your retail people that get your research letter, are they able to participate in those? Do they just have to have an Interactive Broker account, even if they're Americans, or how does that work?
Yeah, I mean, we always tell people that the best that I've come across is Interactive Brokers for the broadest market exposure. You can buy pretty much anything around the world. It's got the best fee structure. Also importantly, IB don't run a prop desk. So, and what I mean by that is, if you look at a lot of the brokers that have screwed people over the years, it's where they've got a large asset management company, they've got a brokerage, division over here, and then they got their proprietary trading over here. And when these guys mess up, they dip in. That's what MF Global did, right? Was they dipped into the funds from across that Chinese wall. And so when I pick brokerage outlets and things of that nature, I'll always look and see, do these guys have a prop desk? And I know in theory and in law they can't commingle funds and all, but we've seen enough of that in the past, where theory and law just get washed away in the time of a crisis, and your business is potentially going to go bust, and you've got the ability to go and tap client capital. Guess what people do? I guess my point is, they don't have a prop desk. I don't have any proprietary trading. So you don't run that sort of risk.
Yeah, so your counterparty risk is not as high with an Interactive Broker. But it sounds like with most of the ideas that you have with your research, whether I'm in Australia, Canada, the UK, United States, wherever I am, in the world, as long as I have an Interactive Broker account, then I can most likely participate with most of the ideas that you 100%. Suggest in your research.
Okay. I mean, most of the time, even with like a Schwab account, the way that we'll do, we'll structure stuff for the research service is we'll have the particular sector or theme that we're into, and then we'll give multiple ways of executing on that theme. Okay. And that's going to differ. Some of our clients are fund managers who will get into, structured options trades or whatever the case might be. And other people are just like, whoa, that's just too much for me. I just want something pretty simple. It might be an ETF. It might just be three or four. We kind of almost structure our own little ETFs, if you will, and there'll be a number of different equities. And in those instances, 90% of the time, you can do that through just a fairly traditional account.
And your research letter walks you through how to do that. And whether you're someone who wants to get into an ETF or maybe buy individual stocks, or to your point, build your own little ETF, that's available in your...
Yeah. I mean, we'll give, like I said, a sector that we're interested in, and then we'll give the ways that you can execute on that. And the pros and cons to that, and then you can, choose from that bucket, if you will, as to which of those suit you, because it's really going to depend on your own skill set and so on and so forth. But most of the stuff you can do with a fairly traditional Schwab or TD America trade account. But certainly, if you're looking to set up an account, then I have not found a better broker thus far than IB, and I don't get paid to say that. I used to use Saxo, who used to be really good, and they just got shittier and shittier over the years. I still have accounts with them, but by and large, 99% of what we do is just through IB.
I sure appreciate it. It's been fascinating. And I know people are going to love this kind of part two just as much, if not more, than they enjoyed part one. So for the promotion that your guys were nice enough to give my viewers, we'll go ahead and put that up on the screen so you guys can look at that. We'll put a link, an affiliate link. It's a great way to get a fantastic deal on some amazing, amazing research. As you can tell, Chris really knows his stuff, and it's a great way to support the channel. But for those of you who want to just find out more about your backstory, should they just go to Twitter? And I think you're Capitalist EXP on EXP. Twitter. Is that the best place?
Yeah. Or the website, Capitalist Exploits.
Okay.
I'm just there.
All right, buddy. Well, I appreciate your time again, and I can't wait to do it again.
No, it's been a pleasure. Always fun to chat to you, George.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.